Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 174, we host a special journal club discussion regarding three recent publications on the theme of gender equality in medicine. Dr. Zelia Correa, Ashvini Reddy, and Divya Schreather make up our panel. The articles are listed in the episode description. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also, you can now claim CME credits via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim those credits for select episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by three women physicians to comment on this journal club. First, in alphabetical order, we have Dr. Zelia Correa, who is professor of ophthalmology and oncology at the Wilmer Eye Institute in the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins Medicine, where she is also the Tom Clancy Endowed Professor of Ophthalmology and Director of Ocular Oncology and Echography in the Retina Division. Zelia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jay. This is a great opportunity. I appreciate the invitation.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. Ashvini Reddy, who is an Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at the Dean McGee Eye Institute in Oklahoma. Ashvini, welcome back.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And last but not least, Dr. Divya Schreather, who is Chief of Interventional Radiology at Harlem Hospital on faculty at Columbia University School of Medicine, and my much more talented and brilliant sister. Divya, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for the opportunity. I am really excited to talk about this very hot topic.
So we have three articles, and they kind of lead into each other. So just to preview, one of the articles is going to be about the effect of domestic responsibilities on career satisfaction for physician mothers in procedural and non-procedural specialties. Another article is going to touch on the fact that maybe domestic responsibilities don't account for all of the discrepancies that we see in medicine. And the last article was kind of a best practices article from Lancet, which kind of synthesized these ideas, and we can talk about what are kind of best practices to really help promote women in medicine and academic medicine. So the first article to discuss is entitled Association of Domestic Responsibilities with Career Satisfaction for Physician Mothers in Procedural versus Non-Procedural Fields. It was published in JAMA Surgery. I'll briefly summarize. So this study was essentially an online survey that was distributed via a Facebook group called Physician Moms. And they were able to collect data from just over 1,700 attendings in 2015. And the interesting thing, kind of the take-home point, was they were able to separate women who were in procedural versus non-procedural fields. And they were able to separate women based on how many domestic responsibilities and which domestic responsibilities they were responsible for, given that the majority of women that responded were in either a partnership or a marriage. The interesting thing seen was that for women in procedural specialties who are responsible for what they defined as five or more domestic tasks, they were much more likely to report a desire to change careers than those who had less than fewer five tasks. And this was not seen in women in non-procedural fields. That was the kind of the biggest take-home point. Given the increasing numbers in the medical workforce, both in procedural and non-procedural fields, we really have a demand that maybe these domestic tasks need to be distributed more equitably. Zelia, I'll let you comment first. What are your take homes when you see this data, and what the implications it for how we can improve things?
Well, I think this article really spoke very closely to me because it is sort of a cultural female kind of inherited habit that we usually take on everything. We try to multitask, we try to do everything. And obviously that makes it very complicated when you have a specialty that you're doing procedures, you have to do interventions, and that level of stress, it makes you feel pulled in a very different direction. So I think that those that have more clinical responsibilities usually can find the time to maybe between a patient or two, make a phone call, check on the kids and that sort of thing, and see if the cleaning lady came in to work and everything. But if you're doing surgeries all day and you may be stuck in a procedure for 3-4 hours, You have the responsibility of getting your kid at home or doing something for your house, making sure something got cleaned up, et cetera. It's very, very stressful, and it makes you very dissatisfied. You're there, you're trying to concentrate, but you can't. And I think because we traditionally, us women, and I'm not saying that, you know, the men don't have a responsibility to also jump in, but I think we volunteer too much. I volunteer too much. You know, I say, okay, there's something to be done. I'm just going to go and do it. I'm not going to ask for help. And I think that in that regard, we too, as women, we need to know when to ask for help, when to delegate. I feel that when young women come and talk to me, they say, oh, but you know what? I feel so guilty not to be doing everything that I saw my mother doing or my grandmother doing or my aunt doing. And I think that we have to realize that it's not about doing every little thing, but about doing the things that count, the things that are important for our family. Being there at the holiday event party, you don't have to cook for everybody. You can buy takeout. You know, you don't have to be there to, you know, bathe your kids or get them off to school every day. But hey, you have to be there for their audition, their soccer games when they're getting their awards. You have to be there to go over their homework. So I think that prioritizing and asking for help, to me, are key things. And I would like to hear what the other ladies in the call have to say about that.
Divya, your comments?
Sure. So caveat is that I don't yet have children, but I have a lot of thoughts on this article. I think, as Zelia just said, I do agree that there is a difference in the amount of control you have over your schedule as a procedural physician versus as a non-procedural physician, because, you know, even the fact that we had to reschedule this call because of a change in the OR schedule illustrates that. So I think that lack of control can certainly create a stressor when you have to, you know, make it to pick up your kids or get out at a certain time, particularly as it seemed in this article that a lot of the women in procedural specialties, the physician mothers, were married to other physicians or surgeons and, you know, therefore didn't necessarily have like somebody who had a much easier schedule to pick up the slack. I guess picking up the slack is a little judgmental, but anyway, but to help when you can't control your schedule. But I think that what struck me about this are a few potential confounders and like some selection bias, where I think that for the most part, potentially with the exception of obstetrics and gynecology, most of these procedural and surgical specialties we're talking about are male dominated. And the personality of women who choose to enter those specialties marks them as outliers in at least one regard, in the fact that they're entering a specialty where they're not the norm. And I would argue that they also do tend to be, we also tend to be overachievers, and we place really high demands on ourselves. And this is a little bit the lean in phenomenon that was initially really specialized and then was perceived to have maybe put undue burden on women to overachieve in every arena, at home, at work, at everywhere, and be perfect everywhere. So I do think that that exists. And I think that selecting from this physician mother group probably compounds that, because there actually aren't percentage-wise that many proceduralists in the group, right? The people surveyed, it was like about a quarter of them were from procedural specialties. And it's like a group for people, for women, mothers, who identify strongly with this mother role, which isn't bad or good, but it's just something that they identify strongly enough with that they're in this Facebook group. And so it really may weight it towards people who perceive these sacrifices maybe more acutely.
Ashwini, anything to add?
I agree with what both of you have basically said. I agree about the selection bias. Physician Moms Group has published some other articles that are prone to the same biases. I think it's really hard because everybody is in sort of a different spot in life, and that spot is changing. As I was reading through these articles, I felt like a lot of them applied to me directly. I have a young kid and I have a young family, and so I understand the balance. I'm really lucky in that I honestly think my husband does 60% of what I, but I take charge of our kid. The car seat is in my car. So if, you know, we were in Oklahoma and his daycare was like hit by a tornado recently and we had to deal with some stuff, but like all the transportation and stuff falls, you know, kind of on me more than anybody else, the time sensitive aspects of it. And so juggling the inflexible career of a proceduralist with the inflexible demands of an infant is hard, and it's not undoable. My husband and I have fun doing it, but it does require a lot of attention to detail. And I think that I can understand, you know, I work in an environment with really supportive colleagues who've been very helpful. On snow days, I've been able to bring my kid into, you know, my office and things are fine. But I can understand in an inflexible environment how hard that would be.
Yeah, those are great points. You know, I, one thing I thought about, and Zelia, you referenced kind of the culture of kind of societal culture. Divya, you kind of referenced maybe the culture of women who enter these fields. And Ashwini talked about some of the challenges. But as Divya mentioned, women can be a minority, and though that's improved in some in a lot of these fields, I wonder how much of this just the culture of some of these procedural fields, because women are relatively new entrants, just isn't as conducive. So we've talked about kind of the home factors, we've talked about the inherent factors of the type of women who tend to pursue procedural fields, but I think also there's procedural fields in general in medicine tend to have a different culture. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but it was a culture built on the fabric of many men who didn't necessarily carry many domestic responsibilities at home. So yeah, sometimes it's uncontrolled and sometimes there's procedures you just can't do. But, you know, sometimes I feel like it's different. And I think every subspecialty of medicine has procedural and non-procedural fields. In ophthalmology, for example, retina tends to be more procedure heavy in terms of weird hours and weekends than other fields. Divya, you can comment a little bit on diagnostic and interventional, for example, very, very different fields. But I wonder how much of that culture needs to change too, because, and one of the things they offered were some potential solutions, you know, extended childcare services, you know, again, some help, especially when there's dual physician families, maybe in the same institution. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on terms of changing work culture. And I'll start with Zelia.
Well, I think changing culture is probably one of the hardest things in life, because it really is very ingrained. And I think, Joe, you really touched on very important things. You know, the procedural field has been kind of characterized or outlined, or kind of, you know, the culture has really been delineated by males that had very strong home support. And so, you know, they were workforces and they were there the whole time and they didn't have a family life for the most part. And, you know, many of them had very unhappy home lives, which is even worse. But I think changing culture really starts from us, from institutions, and having, you know, daycare right at the institution. Some places have that. Being able to offer after-hour care. You know, there's a lot of services out there that have kind of like a concierge that some institutions can hire, or companies. I've heard about, you know, different services like that in big cities, that when, you know, they recruit somebody and they know that they're junior, they can also say, okay, we're also giving you X number of hours of concierge services to help you get, you know, different type of things that you don't know. I think the hard thing, and I think Ashwini can comment on that, is when you're going into a different city and you have to figure out everything. It's your first job. It's your new job. Once you have that rhythm of life and you figure things out, I think it gets a lot easier. But summarizing my comments, I believe that it's driven by us women. I think it's driven by men in the different specialties that do find the value of having women in procedural fields. It's driven by institutions that want to attract this diversity and can offer different options and different support systems, and I think that that will probably be a significant attraction to be able to recruit the best and the brightest, because nowadays everybody wants and looking at work-life balance, and I think that that's something that would really set apart certain places that could offer something like that.
This is actually, I was just going to second everything that Zelia said and say, you know, I think that all organizations are looking to attract and retain women, and those offerings, when they're available, are just gold. I know women in ophthalmology and medicine who take full advantage of on-site daycare. That's a huge, huge thing. Huge thing. Sick child care at work. So if your kid suddenly wakes up and can't go to his regular daycare and has those options at work, those kinds of small things that maybe you wouldn't think of as changing the work culture, you know, affect employee absenteeism. They improve mood, and they make, I think, work environments very equitable. So they're great.
You know, I'm going to get Divya's thoughts in a second, but not to make the conversation more complicated, I'm going to introduce the second article as part of this journal club, and that was entitled Parenthood Does Not Explain the Gender Difference in Clinical Position in Academic Medicine Among Swedish, Dutch, and Austrian Physicians. This was a European study that looked at those three countries and looked at academic physicians at three university hospitals, each in a different country, and they did a cross-sectional questionnaire study. 54% of the women, of the participants were women, and they had over 1,300 participants. And the biggest take-home point was that there were gender differences in clinical position. There were gender differences in publication activity, both in which women were likely to publish fewer articles and have a lower clinical position. And this was not explained by the number of children or working hours. And they kind of talk, maybe this is things like household labor, maybe it's the academic working environment, things we've already talked about in the context of childcare or domestic responsibilities. But even in country, and they reference that Sweden's very advanced in terms of gender equality in general, overall, compared to the United States, for example, it's not completely maybe a home issue. And so, Divya, I'll let you start. You know, you look at this survey data. It matches, unfortunately, some data we've seen from the U.S. in ophthalmology, I know, and other fields of medicine. I mean, what kind of factors really play a role in this? How much of this is self-selection? How much of this is just culture?
I have a lot of thoughts. Actually, I have some thoughts on our previous conversation about work culture, but we can put a pin in it and come back to those. But I think that this study illustrates a few different factors. I do think that they're attributing like the number of, or kind of, using the number of children or working hours as a proxy for the home responsibilities may not totally hold water. I think as we saw in the previous study, like home responsibilities, some of those things that were listed are not specific to parents. They're not something that necessarily scales with the number of children that you have. So things like, you know, arranging childcare, yes, is child specific, but planning vacations or arranging for home cleaning or that kind of thing. There's an unequal allocation typically of these household duties, whether or not they also involve child related responsibilities. And so I think that that can explain the publication in part, because the amount of time you have outside of the hospital may vary based on gender in partnered people. Separate from that, I think there's been a fair amount of publication on mentorship and sponsorship. And I do think that that is very material when it comes down to when we're talking about publication opportunities and speaking opportunities. There's been data that has shown that female women mentees compared to male mentees are offered fewer publication and speaking opportunities by their mentors, regardless of the mentor's gender. And so that's kind of what we think of as sponsorship. You can have a mentor, and I think there are most professional organizations these days, most, you know, even outside of medicine, most organizations are really mindful about trying to create mentorship programs for underrepresented underrepresented groups, including women in many high-powered fields. But the question is, when does mentorship actually translate into sponsorship, which is what produces results? It's when you hand off the lecture or the review article that you don't have time to do to your junior person. And that disproportionately is passed to men more by both women and men as mentors. And I think that it's, you know, difficult to parse, but it has been published on. And I think it's relevant, and it may tie into the perception or reality that women have a larger number of responsibilities outside of work, and therefore they don't maybe need to have extra work coming to them. And maybe that's the perception that leads to that. That's conjecture, but there are data that definitely support the conclusion that sponsorship for female mentees is not as robust.
And Zelly, I'll get your thoughts in one second, but Ashvina, you've published extensively in ophthalmology on the subject of academic rank, chair, for example, and editorial boards. I mean, this data matches up with some of the things that you've discussed in those publications. Any thoughts on what Divya just commented on, and how can we're going to work towards our final goal, which is how do we improve this?
Well, I mean, I think the first step is always awareness. And so, you know, people have asked me, you know, how did you come up with the idea to write about some of the stuff you have? And I was like, well, you know, honestly, when I was looking into it, I'm a data analyst type of person. I just like looking at the data. And so many people had come to me with hypotheses. And I, you know, I just thought a lot of this is very testable, right? Numbers exist. Data is out there. We just have to gather it and set it up the right way for analysis. And so we did. And I think that just an awareness of disparity and awareness of the challenges that women face is really all that most people kind of need to give them sort of that gentle reminder that, hey, we want to make sure that we're being fair to anybody, everybody. Is everyone on the team getting a fair chance? Am I conscious promoting every person and giving every person fair opportunities? And, you know, the vast, vast, vast majority of people in medicine are trying very hard to do that. And I really think that, you know, the landscape of medicine is changing. And as more women are entering medicine, institutions, departments, and individual practices are trying really hard to retain those women and to bolster them. So I feel like there's a lot of positive forward momentum here.
Zelia, your thoughts? I mean, what you've seen, you've been at a couple different institutions in your career. Any final thoughts? And before we talk about best practices?
I agree with all the comments, and I agree very much that it's not just about how many kids you have or how young your family is. It's about sponsorship. It's about opportunities. And it's very interesting that I was speaking with some of the women in the recent Pan American meeting, and I was asking them how many times did they enlist other women when they were organizing sessions at meetings, when they were thinking about, you know, coming up with a project or writing a paper and this and that. And a couple of them did recognize that they didn't usually think about the women. And I thought, why not? I mean, you're so great. You do such great work. So I think it's, again, it's important to raise awareness. It's important to talk to your friends. I mean, I have been very fortunate that I chose a specialty that is kind of very unusual, uncharted territory, ophthalmology. So, and I had a mentor, and it was, I was really the person that worked on the projects with him and everything. But I do see that as we move up in the career ladder, it becomes harder and harder. As you move up, I think there's more and more barriers. I felt that early on in my career, people weren't blocking you, or they weren't not giving you chances or opportunities. I think as you get older and you become more senior, I think people feel that, you know, giving you opportunities is going to maybe be detrimental to others. So I think that's important as well to keep in mind, that not just, you know, the younger women, the junior women, but keep promoting and keep encouraging that, because we see that there is a huge number of women in medicine right now going into the workforce, the younger generation. But why aren't we, you know, equally in positions of leadership? why aren't we equally publishing? Why, you know, so there's all that continuum into profession and career, because is it that women get beat down or they feel beat down and they end up just quitting and just saying, oh, I'm just going to work part-time, or academics may not just be for me, you know, I'm just going to try to do something else. So I think I'm talking more of an experience and years and years in practice, but I think those are important points.
And I'm going to take final thoughts from everyone in a second, but just this helps bring in the last article, which was entitled Organizational Best Practices Towards Gender Equality in Science and Medicine. And this was published as a review in Lancet. And the authors, interestingly enough, come from Canada and South Africa. So once again, more of an international flavor to these articles, and maybe from countries such as Canada, which may have improved gender equality compared to us. And they, just to summarize before we again discuss this, they kind of looked at all the different ways that you can improve this, right? So they talked about organizational culture and climate, like we discussed, inclusive leadership. So, you know, making sure to, as Zelia was saying, to kind of help people not only just advance, but get to leadership positions, and leaders kind of bringing people up with them. Academic societies, improving this. And then, you know, even legislative attempts, you know, where there's been quotas done in other avenues. So, for example, in South Africa, seems a little extreme, but maybe in certain instances, we need to just tell people that there's a certain number. And even though we don't like the idea of quotas, maybe that's kind of the final way to improve things. Divya, you know, when you hear this best practices and kind of think about this, obviously a multifaceted approach is going to be most successful. But in the United States, and this is kind of where we're going to end, and we can touch on anything we didn't hit. Where are we lacking the most? Like, where if we really want to make this happen, and it's going to happen slowly but surely, where are the areas we can improve the most? And maybe it differs between, for example, interventional radiology and ophthalmology.
Sure. So, I mean, taking like a giant picture view of it, I think that countries in Northern Europe, such as the ones that you know were looked at in the last study, have a created policies on a national level across all industries and fields that acknowledge that high-level professionals of both genders need to be able to also raise families. And I think that's, we're not quite there yet in this country. And that's, it's in progress. And I think, as Zelia is saying, like, the first step is awareness and setting the intention and, you know, recognizing the value of changing culture. But I think big picture, that's, you know, we're behind in the U.S. across all industries in general on, you know, parental leave, on childcare, on just basically being able to support families who have high-powered professional parents. Culture change is hard, and this is actually the anecdote that I wanted to throw in earlier when we were talking about work culture. But I'm in another Facebook group for women in IR. It's not just for mothers, but it's for, you know, our rare breed, because IR is about 8% women at the last census. And a friend of mine posted, who had just had a baby and was coming back from maternity leave, asking for suggestions on breast pumps that would fit under lead, because we work in lead for a lot of our fluoroscopy procedures. And it was just so illustrative that we are we are conforming to the culture. We are finding a way to be professionals, be parents, and be women. And at the same time, like, just because, again, we're able to lean in and do everything backwards and heels with a smile and really just like bear the brunt of that culture clash, I think it doesn't mean that we shouldn't lobby for culture change. And I think within medicine, certainly in IR, and it sounds like in all these ophthalmologic subspecialties, there's an interest. There's a genuine, passionate interest in achieving these goals of gender parity, of making it appealing for women to enter these fields, or at least be disincentivized. But culture change is slow, and there's certainly, like, in diagnostic radiology versus interventional radiology, there's a sense of, well, you know, you could have just like stayed as a diagnostic radiologist. You chose this. You chose this lifestyle. You chose to do something that would make your life like this. And I think that's actually kind of gender agnostic. They like say that to male interventional radiologists as well. because there's such a huge discrepancy between the shift work lifestyle of being a diagnostic radiologist and being a surgeon. And I think in ophthalmology, I'm sure there's a similar divide, but maybe not as steep of a drop-off, because really between diagnostic radiology specialties and IR, there's this huge gulf, even though some diagnostic radiologists may do procedures. So I think that, you know, the sense that other people who are in these same work environments, because most interventional radiologists outside of academia practice in mixed diagnostic IR groups, are basically seen as having chosen masochistically this line of work, and therefore you get whatever it comes with. And so I think that there's a particular challenge in my specialty outside of academics, but I'm curious how that plays out in ophthalmology, where there is certainly a range of lifestyle differences in depending on what subspecialty you might choose to practice. So I'm curious to hear from Ashwini and from Zelia about that.
Ashwini, would you like to go first?
Yeah. When you said the phrase, you know, she chose this, it rang a bell for me, because someone said that about a woman that I knew when she was pregnant. And honestly, like dealing with a lot of stuff and trying to get through, you know, a difficult case and kind of an extremely busy schedule, there was someone who turned to me and said, well, she chose it. She chose to get pregnant. She chose this field. You know, this is her choice. And I was like, well, you know, my mind was more on, well, let's help her get through this hard time the way that I would help, you know, a male colleague with a broken leg or whatever, you know. So I think there, you know, there's sort of this, there's an interesting kind of, I think there are people who kind of expect fields to be static, right? Which is, this is the way interventional cardiology has always been, and this is the way it'll always be, and you'll always adopt this lifestyle. And you'll, you know, like you'll live the way that we've lived, and they keep that metric going, you know? And I think there are newcomers to the field who say, look, you know, life is fluid and things are dynamic, and we should be flexible and understanding of, you know, people who are entering the field, men, women, minorities, you know, and say, look, these are challenges that these people have at this point in their life. And we want our field to always be friendly to people who are coming in. And I think that's the foundation of a lot of the articles featured in this journal club and the articles featured by almost any STEM journal. The foundation is that, you know, we really want for the playing field to be more even, and we want everyone to feel welcome. So I think these articles really kind of are very constructive in that way.
Zelia, your thoughts?
I want to second everything they said. I believe that the whole idea that, oh, you know, she's pregnant because she chose to, or she has a family because she chose to. Yeah, you know, she did choose that, but that's part of life. And so the whole kind of the guilt thing is just really terrible. And I think, again, that's part of the culture, and that's part of the burden that, you know, women carry. And that is significant in the kind of the perpetuation or the upkeep of this gender inequality. I think the moment that we say, you know what, we are also human beings, that's how, you know, people live, and they can have different sort of family structures, they can have kids or not kids, but we are not only professionals, and having a happy personal life is part of being a good physician. The very important part. You're not healthy if you don't have a good life. And so I think that the moment we all figure out that having a good life is an important part of being a good physician, institutions will be more supportive of that. Our colleagues will be more supportive of that. I personally love it when some of my friends say, gee, you know, I have this place that I need to go to, or this meeting that I have to attend to, but I can't because my kid has this thing. Can you help me find a replacement? And I say, you know what? Absolutely. Let's find somebody to replace you. That you should do that. because we can't be all doing everything. And many times we need to figure out that balance and things that, again, are important and need to be prioritized. But the way these choices are perceived by all of us, by peers, by institutions, by organizers, by leadership, that's extremely important, because that's what really sort of endorses that, you know, this or that professional has a rank of priorities in their life. And I think that's amazing. That's mentally healthy. That's just, you know, what it's all about. So I'm going to say we have to, all of us, you know, and endorse the prioritization, and that people are allowed to make choices and say, you know what, yes, this is very important, but maybe not this time, maybe next time. Or, you know, I'm going to have to ask help and then prioritize this professional aspect of my life.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. We went well over to discuss these articles. I'll open the floor, you know, just final thoughts from anyone, anything else you wanted to add. Maybe we'll go around and work our way back. I'll start with Divya. Any final thoughts? Anything you wanted to add?
Well, I was going to say, I know that I cited some data that seems like disheartening, and like maybe some of my feedback was critical in general. But my feeling on this topic is actually overall hopeful. The fact that we're having these conversations is not even the first step, but like a middle step in arriving at a solution. And I think having men interested in having these conversations and not having it siloed as like a women's issue is huge. And furthermore, I think that, again, like, for example, the issue of like mentorship versus sponsorship that I brought up, like, I don't think that's conscious. I think it's likely largely unconscious bias. And so just by having that publication out and having it discussed, I think behavior will change. And similarly, with these other articles we've discussed and with the conversation we're having, I think awareness creates change, because I don't think many of these dynamics are intentional. And they certainly don't fit with what most people, from what I've seen in medicine, really want. And so, you know, light disinfects. And I think that awareness is the first step. And I think this has been a great conversation to have about it.
Ashwini?
Yeah, I think that I'm so grateful to you for having arranged for this. I'm so grateful to everyone who's listening in and whose wheels are turning. I think that it was a really excellent discussion. And I think that it will really kind of feed forward. And a lot of the topics that we've discussed today are great food for thought, whether you're early in your training or whether you're really established and want to make sure that your organization, you know, is dynamic and progressive. So thank you so much for putting this together.
And last but not least, Elia?
Well, I couldn't agree more. Divya, Ashwini, you guys really made the whole discussion just so lively and just wonderful. It's important to raise awareness. I think this is what it's all about. And I think this was a great opportunity. And just saying, Jay, thank you so much for thinking about all these things and really showing the younger generation that there's a lot more to our profession, to medicine, than just, you know, being an excellent physician. Being an excellent physician means being healthy mentally, physically, and so forth. And many times we are very focused on excelling professionally and we forget all those things. And we see so many people burn out, so many excellent talent go to waste because, again, the situations, the circumstances weren't adequate. And sometimes people quit. And that's really sad to see. And I think awareness is what it's all about. And supporting each other, supporting our friends, and, you know, just making sure that everybody has an opportunity to really flourish and be the best they can be. But thanks so much. This is amazing.
Thank you all, and have a great night. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 174 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Here's a huge update. Remember, you can claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. On our website, you can sign up for the mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as the Android Store. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcasts and Android stores directly on your mobile device. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contest link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate any who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Correa, Reddy, and Schreeder for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benicasa for preparing this episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
The feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.